This is Morgan Michael, welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness, together by challenging our assumptions and venturing beyond the status quo in education. We can make a big impact, one small act at a time.
Number one, you are enough. And number two, believe in yourself, have faith and trust. You've got this.
I want to introduce you to my friend, David Knapp Fisher, a connection ninja, speaker, author, world traveler, and speaking coach. In this episode, we talk about his journey as an advocate for his son living through muscular dystrophy, what it takes to set and achieve audacious goals, how self-education is the key to the future, the importance of service and gratitude in helping you get to where you want to be, and the four steps to creating lasting connections with the people you serve. Can't wait to hear your takeaways from this action-packed podcast. David Knapp Fisher, thank you so much for being on Kindsight 101 today. I am thrilled to have you on the show.
I am thrilled to be here. It's taken us a few months to get here, but here we are on a beautiful sunny day in Victoria.
That's right. So your journey is quite an inspiration. You've gone from being someone who sort of maybe let life happen to him to someone who takes life by the horns, appreciating all that it has to offer. So I want to just rewind and start with your own experience at school. Your dad was in the Navy, and so you traveled around a lot, is my understanding. So what kind of a student were you, and what was your overall impression of school?
I was a pretty good student, I think, until about grade eight. And then I learned what has become my life, which is how to socialize. And it's funny because I barely scraped through grade 10 and 11, and I never actually graduated in grade 12. And my parents, as you mentioned, my family, my father was in the Navy, so we moved around a great deal, including 3 years spent in England. And what really was, you know, it was a very disciplinarian household. My father was, you know, very staunch English disciplinarian, and kind of everything that went along with that. So I think my parents didn't really understand my wanderlust and my kind of go against the grain, fight authority point of view. So basically a week after I got out of high school, my parents literally kicked me out of the house. So I very quickly had to shift from being a bit of a high school slacker to making minimum wage and supporting myself. And, you know, I was fairly well equipped, but boy, there were some hard lessons there. So that's when I really sort of had to sort of look. And I think the thing that was very defining for me is it didn't take me too long to realize that I was lacking an education of some kind. And I partly blamed my school. And at the time I blamed my parents and I blamed everybody, but I still realized it was up to me if I was going to make something happen. And that was kind of a defining point for me.
I bet. And I'm just thinking back to that moment that you stopped sort of attending school. That must have been a really tough time in some respect. And what did that do to your self-concept at the time?
Well, I never actually stopped attending. I went right through to the end. I just never graduated. And then with my parents going, you know what, basically, you're a slacker. It's time you get out of here, which really happened. I'm not kidding. A week later, I suddenly was, you know, I fought a thirst. I thought, this is so cool. I can do all the things I've always wanted to do. I can buy the things I've wanted to buy. I can stay up late. And then suddenly you realize, oh, but I've got to work 40 to 50 hours a week at minimum wage to try and pay rent. And so when all my friends wanted to come over and hang out because it was so cool, I had my place, but they would go home to, you know, moms and dads who would feed them and buy them clothes and let them stay for free. And I really had to grow up very, very quickly. And it was really tough. I mean, it made me, I definitely had some anger about it towards myself, and insecurity, if I'm going to be honest. The insecurity piece, as I think with a lot of us, really drove me. I knew I didn't want to live the lifestyle my parents had, which was one of lack. But I also knew that, you know, I had to work. I wasn't smart. I was not a smart person. That was my vision of myself. So I figured I would try and, you know, fool people by being a hard worker. And that's what I did. I worked exceptionally hard in kitchens, as a matter of fact. I worked in restaurant kitchens and hoping nobody would find out that I was stupid.
Oh, isn't that funny? And I think the reason I ask about that is because I think you're definitely not the only one who's felt that, right? And mm-hmm. What If you could rewind and go back to that time, what would you tell your past self if you could?
Two things. Number one, you are enough. Absolutely. And number two, just believe in yourself, have faith and trust. You've got this.
Amazing.
You've got this. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm the youngest of four, and without getting too deep into family dynamics, you know, I'm the only one with the entrepreneurial spirit. I'm the only one who's really sort of gone out there. All my siblings kind of followed my parents' very safe lifestyle. And it was always, I was frowned upon as kind of this reckless guy. And now I'm, you know, I'm closer to 60 than I am to 50. And I look back and I realize, you know what, I had it right all along. Maybe I could have done a few things differently. I'm sure we all could have, but the right idea, because I always did it with a kind heart. I mean, I never tried to do anything that was underhanded or that lacked integrity. I just wanted to work hard, learn, do my best, and show people that I could get things done. And so without any traditional education, you know, I just thought I could do that through hard work. You know, another huge turning point for me was when I discovered reading books. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was it for me. Mm-hmm. I picked up a book. It was called Seeds of Greatness, the 10 Best Kept Secrets of Success. And I remember thinking, 10? I didn't even know there was one best kept secret. So I bought the book and I read it cover to cover in 24 hours. And it was like somebody was speaking, the author, Dennis Waitley, was speaking directly at me. And he was saying, whatever you do, or whatever you're good at, whether regardless of how society sees it, that's your gift. Use it to the fullest. And that's when I realized I can do something well. I can do something, some good.
And you do. And you do. I've seen it in action. I was going to actually ask you about books. So I know that you're a big proponent of reading and self-education, and believe that that's a really important piece to self-actualization too. Can you share any other titles that have stood out for you that you would recommend to others in terms of, you know, I think this is largely geared toward educators, but I think what about those students who are kind of outliers, who maybe don't fit the mold? What could be some important books that they could look to?
You know, that's a great question. I read every day for an hour, and I only state that because, well, every day being 5 to 6 days a week, I book an hour, and it's actually booked. It's in my calendar to read, because I do believe so much that, you know, when you read a book that's written by somebody like a Tony Robbins or a Richard Branson or a Mark Manson, you're reading it from somebody who's been there, done there. It's just not theory. This is actual practical advice from people that have been in the trenches, been in the muck, and have come out and have a story to tell. And so some books that I really love, Tim Ferriss, who's written The 4-Hour Workweek, which was a game changer for me. He's got a couple of books. One's called Tribe of Mentors, and the other one's called Tools for Titans. And they're basically the same format, where he interviews all these top achievers and he asks them the same 6 to 10 questions. So it's very interesting to see how, say, a Richard Branson would answer the same question as Arnold Schwarzenegger.
That's right.
And it's a fantastic. So that's full of great advice. I would be remiss if I didn't mention my all-time favorite book is Walden by Thoreau.
Yes.
It's a classic piece of literature that I picked up, written in 1854, and it is more prevalent today in the art of simple living than ever. We've all heard the Thoreau quote, "The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation." Has that ever applied more than today, in a world where people are, you know, depressed and sitting in front of cell phones and computers all day long and don't know how to speak each other?
And
this is a book that's, you know, 150 years old. So I reread that every couple of years. So those are some books. Anything by Mark Manson, you know, The Subtle Art of Giving an
Yes,
F.
Yes.
Fantastic. He's got a sequel coming out. He's a very brilliant guy that, again, not highly educated, but came through the trenches. Yeah, those are the kind of people that really speak to me. People that have been there, done that, and say, here's the way it goes.
Yes, I love that. And I think about the fact that you're not a stranger to adversity, and yet you made it work for you. So you moved up this chain within hospitality. You started in kitchens and you gradually kind of moved up and settled down and eventually had your own family and had a son. Is that correct? And
yep, my son is Tristan.
Tristan. And tell me about the moment that you had him and how becoming a father shifted your mindset?
Well, I'd always wanted to become a father. I just loved the idea. And I was in a relationship at the time, and I said to this woman, I want to become a father. We should get married and have a family. And she said, okay. And it was one of those relationships that we all kind of know you shouldn't be in. We've all had a few of them. Sure. But I was so excited to become a father that we agreed to marry because, times were always turbulent back then. Mm-hmm. So we married, and within a year we were pregnant, and then my son was born. And not too long after, I think he was about 1.5, she abruptly ended the marriage. So that was very tough for me because suddenly my son wasn't with me. And then again, she moved away with him. And so that was very hard on me because one of my dreams had always been, and I don't really talk about this stuff publicly. Sure. I think it's in the past. It's over 20 years ago. But it really devastated me, especially when he was taken, moved away. It was very, very hard. Mm-hmm. And it was not long after that he was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy. Mm-hmm. And I found myself living at one corner of the country. I was in Calgary, and they'd moved out to Ottawa. And we always suspected something wasn't right. And, when we went to the doctor, they took him to the doctor, and he was diagnosed. I had no idea what muscular dystrophy was. All I knew about it was that Jerry Lewis held a telethon once a year, and that's it. So I quickly jumped on a plane, flew out to Ottawa, found out about the illness, quit my job, packed up my car, and moved there to be with my son. Mm. And that was a tough, tough hit because, suddenly I'm going to a city where I didn't know anybody. And my son was diagnosed with this illness, but I was determined to be there for him. This is one thing that I'm proud of. I love my son so much. And I've always just tried to make sure I put him first. And as fate would have it, about 6 or 8 months later, they choose to move back to the West Coast. So the wheels turned again. And by then we started to figure out what it would look like co-parenting this boy from two different towns in British Columbia.
Right. Which probably made a lot more sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Easier for sure.
Yes, for sure. So when it comes to your son's journey, I think from an educator standpoint, I actually have a student in my class currently who has muscular dystrophy, and it's been a real eye-opener for me. And I know sometimes the prognosis isn't always rosy, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what would you say to teachers who have students in their class with these types of low incidence special needs in terms of how they interact with you as parents, how they support their students day to day?
That's a great question. I remember going through this with Tristan when he was in school or with his teachers. I think the number one thing we've got to remember about anybody is that they're people. Mm-hmm. And one of the challenges is, for example, Tristan's 23. His muscular dystrophy is a physical disability. It certainly doesn't affect him cognitively. He's very bright, very smart. He's been to college. Yet we will still go into a restaurant and the waitress will look at me and ask me what he wants. Oh. And so it shows and I use this word, in its proper form, it shows the ignorance of people and fear of talking to people with disabilities. And it's really no different than how we treat little children. We have to treat them as people and talk to them as people. And I think it's when we realize that these are people living with disabilities. They aren't the disability. Mm. So in other words, Tristan may not, he's basically a quadriplegic, but he can speak very well. His voice is a little labored because he uses a lot of breathing apparatus, but anybody can sit with him. I can leave him with anybody for an hour. And I will come back and they will say, that is the most fascinating young man I've ever met. Mm. But it's not till they sit down and approach him as a person and have that conversation when they realize that. So one thing we always try to do is, and I've certainly tried to do, is give him as many life experiences as possible that are just normal. And nothing's too much work. If it's like, hey, let's go to 4 stores today, then we will go to 4 stores, even though it means loading and unloading him into his wheelchair van, which is quite a task in itself.
Sure.
Because we've got to let people have their experiences. And that's what I think I would leave with teachers. I mean, we had one teacher who just felt that Tristan was a little bit too much of a burden because he needed more time. And I was at my wit's end. And the principal, bless his heart, finally stood up and said, you know, what I'm hearing here is there's a parent here who is struggling and needs help with his son, and you're not providing it. So let's start taking care of this child. Mm-hmm. And it was really lovely to hear that, because I was just fighting for equal attention for my son. I just wanted to add that, you know, that incident that sparked that meeting with the teacher came about that my son was coming in to school a couple of minutes late because he takes the bus. Oh. But what the teacher didn't realize was that for when most people ask their 10 or 12 year olds to get up in the morning, they come down, give them some cereal and get them on their way. It was a full hour of prep work to get my son up in the morning and then down to a bus. And then he'd take an hour bus to where we were going.
Wow.
And this is what I think a lot of people don't understand, is that there's a lot of work behind the scenes. When people, if somebody has a birthday party and a child shows up who's disabled or an adult, there's usually an hour worth of work to get them there and an hour worth of work after they get home.
Right.
And that was the point. I just wanted to add that in, because that's what nobody ever sees. They just see the person in front of them. And
such an important point, because I think sometimes we have these assumptions based on our own experiences as parents or even if we aren't parents. I mean, getting a kid up in the morning anyway can be tough enough without all mm-hmm. of the steps that it would take you to get Tristan up in the morning. That would have been very difficult. But often our assumptions are, oh, it's just like us. How hard can it be? You know, you don't take that into account, or perhaps people do, but it's a good reminder to really be conscious about what that journey looks like for someone else. So.
Well, and to be fair to those people too, and I mean, it's like when my son was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy, as I stated, I had no idea what it was.
Mm.
Well, they have no idea what it is.
Sure.
And it's only because I live in that world that I now know. It takes an hour to get up or an hour to go to bed every day, like an hour at both times. But how would you know that unless you're in that environment? So that was really what we were trying to do there, was sort of say, you've got to understand this is what we go through before we even show up here. And it was, you know, it all obviously worked out very well in the end. So, yeah.
Would you talk to the travel piece?
Yes, I would love to. If there's one thing I love to talk, it's traveling. So, I mean, I mentioned this in my TED talk. I lived in England as a child. And I was just blown away. We lived in the south, and my father's brother lived in Amsterdam. So we would frequently go back and forth. And I remember having my first breakfast in Amsterdam, and it was cheese, black coffee, and ham. And I was about 8 years old. And my mom said, I said, like, where's the bacon and eggs? And mom says, you're in another country. This is how people eat here. And I remember that, you know, that was 50 years ago. And I still remember that experience. That was where I realized that different countries did different things.
Mm-hmm.
And when about 12 years later, once we'd settled in Canada, I wanted to go back, and I went and I did the typical backpack around Europe. I hit 12 countries in 3 months. And I just was hooked. I just couldn't believe it. And it was, travel is so important to me, because you get to see the world, you get to learn, you get to be grateful for what we have here in our Western world, but you just really get to experience different cultures. And I could never imagine not sharing this with my son. I mean, it is the greatest thing I do in my life. So of course I always dreamed of taking him traveling. And when the muscular dystrophy piece showed up, and you know, I knew that if I was going to do it, I would have to make it happen fairly quickly. But I'd actually done other trips with him. I've actually taken him away 9 times.
Wow. Tell me why you wanted to share that love of travel with him.
I just wanted, you know, I just think there's something about seeing the world and understanding how other people live, you know, that not all, you know, if I need a glass of water, I can go turn on my tap, or what some people do is go to the store and buy a bottle. Yet when I was in Peru, when I wanted water, I had to go with the village ladies, and we had to hike for almost a mile to get water just for dinner.
Wow.
When you expose your children to things that are so different than our culture, especially when they're a little harder, it really shows them how lucky we are. But ironically, and you'll find this, I travel a great deal. I'm just about to hit my 50th and 51st country.
Wow.
When you travel, you find that the people with the least amount are generally A, the happiest, and B, the kindness.
I just had this conversation with Dr. McAdam, this resilience piece, where people who literally have experienced the worst heartbreak, genocide, mm-hmm. famine, all of that, the joy that they feel is just unprecedented. And then you compare that to the level of happiness versus depression here, and you go, like, what is going on? And so it's so interesting.
when the families aren't just bogged down with all of the stuff and the expense and all that, and they just are living simply and they're giving of their heart and, you know, of their open heart, it's amazing. But you just meet the kindest people, and, you know, they'll give you the simplest thing. It might be a rock that means the world to them. And then you can have that rock next to your $20,000 car, and the rock is more valuable to you because you know the intention it came from,
right,
halfway around the world.
That's right. And it just infuses your life with the sense of gratitude and reminds you of what's important.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So that's why travel means so much to me.
I love the work that you do as a TEDx. I mean, you've done this great TEDx speech, and
you
have continued that into the work with Inspired Victoria, which essentially brings world-renowned local speakers and presents them to a crowd who receives them and just, well, basically wants to be inspired. So mm-hmm. how have you taken some of your life lessons and shared them with the world? And how has that helped you in terms of gaining your own footing in the world?
Oh, that's a great question. So I started Inspired Victoria for one reason. There's an old saying by Jim Rohn. I'm sure you've heard it. It says, you are the sum total of the five people you spend the most time with.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of looked at the five people around me and I was a little depressed. I realized I needed a better quality of people around me if I was going to live my dream. I always say that with a bit of jest, but I really realized that nobody had the passion for life that I do. And that passion is born out of sort of growing up being told you can't have that. It's not what we do. And I really felt it was. So I wanted to find those like-minded people. I wanted to find my ilk, my mm-hmm. tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started this, and you know, I asked the first guy we had speak is Mike Vardy. He's the productivityist. Mike just really illustrated this idea that if you have something that makes sense, work hard at it, and then you can live it. That can become your life. And that was what I was the message I was trying to get out to people. But what's really interesting was that was the message I was trying to get out to people at the beginning. But over 3 years of running the organization, it's evolved into something much different. And here is our message now. If you open your heart and you're prepared to do the work to get the things you want out of life, I promise you, I don't hope or wish, I promise you, you stay connected, we can find people that have been there, done that, and can support you in getting there, as well as we can find people who need your talents and skills, and you can help them.
Amazing.
And we can collaborate. And it's been unbelievable. I can't say what a game changer this has been for my life.
Mm, I love that. And I think what's rooted in that, and part of the reason that I wanted you on Kindsight 101, is that there's an element of generosity. And I mean, it's rooted in kindness and generosity, because it's not really about saying, here's what I want for my own success. It's really, how can I serve other people so that they can achieve and propel their own visions for themselves. And within doing that, you connect people to one another. So I do want to ask you, I mean, people have nicknamed you the Connection Ninja, and I would totally agree. I mean, I met you actually through email last spring, and because of you, I've been connected to a number of really phenomenal people and some really interesting concepts and ideas that I just had never had before. And so what are your secrets to creating meaningful connection with people? What's that?
I have to tell you something kind of cute. My friend Janelle Morrison, who I believe you're going to be interviewing soon.
Yes.
Janelle's she's an Iron Man lady who had a horrible car crash, broke both her legs, and came back. And she, I heard her story, and she went and did another Iron Man. It was just incredible. And I'd heard her story, and somehow somebody had told me about her. So I sought her out and we met. And we met 4 years ago, and she's actually watched this whole journey unfold. And she was the one that she was introducing me to somebody. And she said, you've got to meet David. He's a connectivity ninja. And I love that name so much. I actually created a keynote around it and thought, how do we get people, like, how do we teach people to connect? And that's, I think, essentially what you're asking. So
that's right.
I've broken the connectivity ninja. I do a keynote that takes about an hour, but I think I can get it down to 4 minutes for you.
Okay.
There's four steps. It's really very much four steps. And it's everything we've discussed already, except for one, which is the first piece. The first step of connectivity ninja says, you must say hello first. And the key word in that statement is first. Because the person that says hello first takes the leadership position. They don't sit there and hope somebody comes to them or wish somebody comes to them. They take the initiative. They take the step. They become the conduit to that conversation.
Brilliant.
So by taking that step, you're basically guaranteeing you're going to meet somebody. What happens after that introduction? We'll find out. But somebody has to make the first step. So Connectivity Ninja step number one is say hello first. Step two, very simple. It's what you and I both practice, is after we get to talk to somebody a little bit, let's find out how we can support them. Offer support. And I always caution people when it says offer support, I suggest recommending a book that they might want to read or a website or possibly an email introduction. It doesn't mean say, hey, let me help you move your house this weekend or I can drive you to the airport at 4:30 on Saturday. You know, that's a little much to ask of somebody you've just met.
Sure.
But just show them your heart is open to help them, you know, find an answer to a puzzle they've got if you have it. Step three is, you know, life is a two-way street. Once you've helped them and you see things are flowing, if there's something you need, let them know, put it out there. Say, hey, by the way, if you know of anybody with a terrific podcast, I'd like to get this that you think what my message would be suitable for, can you let me know?
Mm-hmm.
You let them know and you kind of put it out there and you've already got, credibility with them because you've shown the kind of person you are. You've introduced yourself, you've helped them get along, and who's not going to say, of course I'm going to help.
Yes.
And then step number four, which I find is where people fall apart most, is the follow-up. Mm. People will have the best intentions in the world, they'll connect with each other, but they'll fail on the follow-up. They'll just say, oh, you know, I got too busy or this happened, and everything before that is wasted if the follow-up doesn't happen.
Right. So the actual action behind the intent.
Absolutely. So just to recap, say hello first, offer support. Not long after, let them know what you need. And finally, follow up. Tie it up with a nice bow. And, you know, if we did that to one person or two people every week, brand new people, imagine compounding over a year the people that have come into our lives.
I love how you package that because I think as an educator, especially with the way that our future is kind of unfolding, there's an inundation of automation and technology and all of this. And so when we think about what are the skills that we're really teaching kids right now, what's important and what do they need out in the real world? Well, I'd say connection and the ability to connect with others is probably right at the top of the list. And so this is a great formula that any educator could pull into their classroom and talk about with their kids, right? And practice through a number of different lessons. I think this is great.
And you know, the other thing that I preach a lot of, because it's certainly, you know, been prevalent for my own success, is really building on our soft skills, our reading and writing. Our writing and speaking.
Right.
Basic communication is so lost today. You know, with everybody texting instead of talking and people, you know, everything's done online and there's, you know, there's certainly an air of deception in a lot of online posts. Mm-hmm. You know, people want their lives to look better than they are, et cetera, et cetera. Being able to stand in front of not even a crowd, just two or three people and say a few words or genuinely ask questions like you're doing today, you know, that's a skill and it's a skill anybody can learn, but it's a skill that will really differentiate the average person from the crowd.
Love it. And
it's so important.
And I think staying with that for a moment, just before we move on to the rapid fire questions, I know that you're a speaking coach as well. And I'd love to hear some of the common pitfalls that you see people having when they do share their stories or they do actually stand up in front of an audience. What are some things that you notice they could change and that a lot of people do that are sort of mistakes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the style of speaking that I do is I like people to tell a story. And basically, I see every speech as having a beginning, a middle, and an end. So I actually learned this and learned how to do this really well when I did my TED Talk. My TED Talk, by the way, it was 7 months of coaching, 4 months of coaching before I was even accepted. Like it was a grueling process. But I really thoroughly, here we are 3 years later, and I'm really grateful I had that because now I understand. So what I see happen, you know, so often is you need to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. So the beginning is basically, here's what I want you to learn. Here's what I'm going to tell you. So for example, in my TED Talk, it's, you know, people come to the end of their lives with regret. Then the middle is the story that illustrates how I learned that and how I dealt with it. Mm-hmm. And then the end is, here's your takeaway. Here's what I'd like you to leave with today to use these ideas, hopefully fueled by the emotion that you got from the story I told, to go make that change in your own life.
Right. Absolutely.
And so, yeah, so that's – and where I see people have challenges is when they go off script, when they get – you know, I call it like, you know, the shiny, you know, a squirrel runs by and suddenly they go off on a tangent on some little side story. So if, let's just say they're talking about the importance of enunciating words. And if they say, when you're speaking, it's really important that you enunciate certain words. I remember I had this friend and then they go off on this long tangent about a friend that might say a word differently, which really has nothing to do with the talk.
Right.
And so you really have to train those people. Not everybody does that, but that takes a 10-minute speech. Suddenly it's a 20-minute speech and they haven't gotten their point out and they're just rambling.
Sure.
That's the number one thing that I see with people that I got to kind of correct them to. I always use the beginning, middle, end formula and then just try to get them to work within that. And ironically, of the 13 or 12 speakers we had at the summit, I coached half of them because they, you know, of what I was looking for, and they used that formula, and I think they did a really fantastic job.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, and you can definitely see speakers who are rocking it, and I think part of it is taking us on a journey and then bringing us back full circle. I think that's such an important piece.
Absolutely, and with a souvenir, and the souvenir is how you can use this to help your own life.
Yes. So in that sort of mood then, before we do move on to the rapid fire, is there anything that you'd like to add? I mean, there is so much that we could talk about. Your blog is amazing. There are so many nuggets of wisdom. I think about the way that you schedule your life with intention is so inspiring. But within the context of this conversation, is there anything that you'd like to leave the listeners with that might provide that nugget of inspiration?
You know, I've already said it and I'll say it again. Exactly. You asked me a great question earlier, is if I could go back and tell myself something. And I would say this to anybody. If you're prepared to, you know, do the work, put in the time, you are enough. You can learn anything. You can do anything you want. You really can. I mean, we live in a Western society that provides us with so many opportunities. And the people that are saying like, oh, I'm bored. Tony Robbins said, and I love this. He goes, people go, I'm bored. Life's boring. And he goes, life's not boring. You're boring. Mm-hmm. Get out and do something. And mm-hmm. I've always liked that because, you know, if we're self-starters and we go out and we push ourselves, you really can. I'm 58 years old. And so now I'm reflecting on my life. And I got it to a point where I'm like, okay, I've earned the right to have this opinion.
Right.
And my opinion is quite simply this. If a high school dropout can go on, I owned my own million-dollar business, I've traveled to over 50 countries, I've raised this son, and I basically retired at 54. I'm not rich, but I'm not poor, but I live this incredibly fulfilling life. If a guy like me can learn to do this by reading books, getting out, and doing stuff, pretty much anybody can. And I don't say all those things to ever impress people, but to impress upon them. It's doable. My life is proof. Find joy in the simple things. And a lot of it has to do with just the way we work with other people and treat our fellow man and show kindness. If we do those and have intention, you know, it's going to work out. It may not look like it at first, but it will work out despite what life throws at you, be it muscular dystrophy with your child or divorces or whatever, bad jobs. We've all gone through certain things. The fact is, we can get where we want to if we put the time and effort in and are prepared to do the work. Anybody can.
What a great message. Thank you for that. Yeah. Where can people find you?
I have a website. It's my name, davidknapfisher.com. I'm there. I'm not super active on Facebook, but I'm there. And I'm hoping I'm going to change that. In the fall, I'm going to be publishing my first book, which I've been writing. It's basically, that's why I haven't blogged for a while. I've actually been spending the past 3.5 to 4 years writing a book, and I'm just on the final editing stage now. The book's title is called Punch Failure in the Face, Then Buy It a Beer.
Love it. Oh, congratulations on that. That's a big achievement.
Yeah, thank you. I'm excited to have it done. It'll be done soon. It's basically, it's 6 sections, and every section has a title, and one is like self-education, and then all the chapters are about two and a half pages long, and they're the strategies that I've learned to live my life, and they're all illustrated with a lot of self-deprecating stories about how I figured things out. But it's a fun book, and it's going to be a great companion piece to any time I do keynoting.
That's fantastic. What does kindness mean to you?
You know, it's really just about opening your heart. You know, and I'd love to tell you I'm great at this, and you know, I struggle in certain areas too, and I like to be very open and transparent. But kindness to me is just taking time to see the person next to you, whoever they are, like really see them. Take a moment. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of people in our world that upset us for various reasons, but sometimes we just need to just step back and just say, how can I support you? Mm. How can I help you? You know,
No, that's great. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, there's so many people that struggle with simple things. You know, one thing that I struggle with, people that constantly want help but don't give back. I think it's got to be a reciprocal thing. Not necessarily I give it to you so you give to me, but if I want to put kindness into the world, I need to know those people are also putting kindness into the world wherever it goes. But this is, again, one of those lessons from cultures. Mm-hmm. You know, people have very little, but they'll give you whatever they've got. Mm-hmm. And that's what it means to me. It means really seeing those people, empathy, love, you know, support. Yes.
And I think you do a really masterful job of facilitating that kind of an environment at your events.
Thank you. Thank you.
What trait or superpower should an educator lead with in order to be effective?
I think, boy, that's a great question. I had two great teachers. One was grade 7, Mr. Mays, and one was grade 9, Mr. Ranum. And I think the thing that I appreciated most about them, and this probably wouldn't be popular with the students, but they had a sense of discipline where they were supportive and helpful, but they expected us to do what we were supposed to do. Mm. And I think that expectation is what made us succeed. If we're constantly lowering the bar or making excuses for our kids not to learn, they're never going to learn.
And finally, if you were able to print one quote or a message onto one of those cups sold in big bookstores, what would it be?
It's a quote by a gentleman named T. Harv Eker. I don't know if you've heard of him, but I love this. It's the way you do anything is the way you do everything.
I love that quote.
And I'll tell you, I have seen this play out everywhere in my life. I'll give you a great example. In my previous life, I did some sales for a food company, and I would sell to the large distributors like a Cisco or a GFS. And I would often go out and I'd ride around with the Cisco or GFS sales reps. And I had a rule. When I would meet them first for a coffee, and I would go look in their car. And if their car was a mess and full of papers and, you know, food wrappers and junk, I would say the way you do anything is the way you do everything. Mm. If this is the amount of attention they put into keeping their car, their office clean, how much attention are they going to put into selling my product?
Mm.
So when I saw somebody who was very clean and fastidious, I'm like, this is somebody, the way you do anything is the way you do everything. They're fastidious. I can work with these guys. Wow. I know it sounds crazy, but it makes sense if you think about it.
Especially if the car is kind of like the office, they're spending a lot of time in it. And that, sure. I mean, that makes so much sense. Fabulous.
Do you know anybody who's perpetually late?
Yes.
Are they making those errors in other areas of their life? Are they taking that little respect to other areas of their life?
Well, yeah, I'd say it can definitely, it can spill over into other areas for sure. Yeah, the lack of intentionality for sure.
Yeah, so I think the reason I like that thing and why I put it on a cup is it reminds us that, hey, if you're not prepared to do your best today, you're not going to do it every day. So always do your best.
Mm, I like that. Well, David Knapp Fisher, this has been amazing and really inspiring. I love how your journey has taken you full circle and how much you do for other people. So thank you for being on the show today.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a real, real honor to be here. I totally appreciate it. And I hope we can see you out one of the times and we'll at one of the events, and we'd love to have you come and talk at it for sure.
I love that.
I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes and leave a review. Thank you so much. This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gain from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag smallactbigimpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.